He's a killer in the ring. Opinions on Andre vary in the boxing community, but many critics agree with Ring Magazine, which named him the most protected prospect. This is just fuel for Andre and Virgil. Andre said, "Fernando Vargas and David Reed, both good friends of mine, went for title shots early, after 12 or 13 fights, and it didn't turn out good. The thing is, at this weight class, guys can be as fast as a welter, but hit as hard as a heavyweight. At smaller weights, you can take more chances. Look at Pavlik. It took him 8 years to get his title shot, and he was ready. He made it to the Olympic trials and lost to Jermaine Taylor. But because I made it a little further in my amateur career, I'm supposed to go twice as fast as a pro? You want me fighting for a title in 2 years?" Andre smiles and shakes his head. He's sure he's on the right track. As of this writing, Andre is still undefeated, with a pro record of 17-0, and the WBO-NABO super middleweight title. He's been developed in an old-school way, brought along slowly, exposed to different styles, without chasing a big payday. But now he's in his prime, and ready, and looking to fight the best guys in the world. Virgil later told me why the critics and the press have a hard time with Andre. "It's hard to recognize what you're watching at first," he said. "He's developed into a fighter who kills in stages, like the lethal injection. You know, with multiple shots. One goes in and sedates you. The next one shuts down the nervous system. The next one stops your heart. It's not a firing squad. That's what's unfolding. People go to fights and look for the wrecking ball. But instead, you have this totally helpless person. I watched the ref watch the other guy. After the second round, the ref never looks at Andre again. He starts watching the other guy closely. He's getting steadily blasted, and he can't do anything back, and he's starting to shut down. The ref sees and feels it first. I watch the faces of people around the ring, and there isn't much cheering or yelling. It's almost somber, like we're witnesses to an execution." Virgil leaned back and looked at me. "And they ask me if he can do that to everybody. And I say, yes, to everybody. It has nothing to do with their skill. I saw it back when he was getting whipped by Glenn, back when he was 10 years old. He was never afraid. He couldn't wait for the day when he could do it back." Captain America. Another man's sword is your sword. Yagyu Muninori. Greatness in sports is born in the moment. It is situational. It's not inherent to the athlete with the most ability or the most dominance, and it's not just about the championship, though that added pressure is essential. It's about the pure moment, the transcendence of time and place, when an athlete or a team performs miraculously under the most intense pressure, against insurmountable odds. The situation rises out of sports, but speaks to universal truths and emotions, an attainment of the divine, touched by grace, indeed miraculous. The moment steps out of time, into history. It becomes important to everyone. Perhaps it's silly for sports to aspire to the grandeur of history, but it happens to us here in the 21st century. It's what we've got. And in the end, fighting is more than a sport. The television announcers aspire to that moment, and they pretend to see it everywhere. They try and force it, hoping for some lucrative historical sheen. But it can't be faked or repeated. UFC commentator Mike Goldberg, calling down goes Franklin, in an attempt, perhaps subconsciously, to recall the iconic Howard Cosell chanting, "Down goes Frazier," doesn't cut it. That guy who yelled, "How much more can you give us, Big Mac?" when Mark McGwire hit his 70th home run in 1998, didn't really nail it. It has to be genuine. Like art, it requires sincerity. The first true gee-whiz moment of modern American MMA is Joe Rogan calling out, "That man is my hero." He was talking about Randy Couture, maybe the greatest MMA fighter to date. Randy is not the best fighter we've seen, or even the most unexpected. And he would almost certainly disagree with my characterization. Nonetheless, I will stick with it. Randy is the first great American MMA fighter. He earned greatness in the moment, not through hype or hyperbole, and not through dominance. His record is 16-8. He's had his share of defeats. Randy earned it with upsets. Randy goes into fights as a serious underdog with regularity, and he pulls off genuine shockers. He does it often enough to make it familiar, and feel inevitable as you see it unfold. Yet each fresh time, it seems he must succumb, and we relearn his greatness. My background, such as it is in striking. I have learned a little jiu-jitsu late, and never really liked wrestling. But the deeper I got into MMA, the more I realized how important wrestling is. At first, when I saw the good wrestlers doing well, I thought it was because of their athleticism and ground control. They don't have a professional avenue open to them after college, unless they're huge and can go into the WWE or the NFL. It made sense that wrestlers would be great ground fighters, and they're already practiced at cutting weight. After several years of MMA, I gradually came to the realization that, in fact, of all the disciplines, wrestling is probably the most tactically important, for the simple fact that if your wrestling is better, then you decide. Meaning if your wrestling is better than your opponent's, you can either A, take him down, or B, prevent him from taking you down. So you decide where the fight goes, and you can make that decision based on where you feel strongest. Randy uses his wrestling, his trapping clinch, dirty boxing, and filthy Greco, to put fighters where they least want to be, and then absolutely smothers them. He drowns fighters right before your very eyes. I realized from Dan Gable and Randy and all these other wrestlers that there is another great edge that elite-level wrestlers bring to the MMA world, mental toughness and conditioning. Mental toughness is a dominant factor in wrestling, and wrestling practices are the hardest in sports. Wrestling has such a huge conditioning factor that the guys who excel have developed extraordinary mental toughness. Indeed, much of the training is focused on pushing through internal walls of exhaustion and breaking your opponent. Wrestling is, by design, a game test, a test of will and conditioning. It's harder than fighting in some ways, because there are so many fewer options. It's man on man and muscle against muscle for the whole match. Randy Couture was an all-state high school wrestler, and he married young after high school. Struggling for work, he joined the Army and wrestled on the Army team. Still, the athletic path was a rough road. Randy was never given anything. He worked for every little step. Eventually, he became a student at Oklahoma State. He was an NCAA All-American. And then he coached at Oregon State. But all the while, he fought to make the Olympic team in Greco-Roman wrestling. Greco-Roman, as opposed to freestyle, is all upper body takedowns and clinches. No attacks on the legs. Randy struggled for 8 years in the international wrestling world, often ranked number one, but never quite winning the right tournament to earn a spot on the Olympic team. He lost critical matches through overtraining or overconfidence. I talked to him at his gym in Las Vegas, Extreme Couture, a mecca for fighters. Randy's got a genuine goodness about him that even the cameras pick up, an honesty, an openness. He has a craggy, noble face that creases into a smile like an old cartoon of the sun. When Randy started fighting, it was almost an afterthought. Let's see if I can do this, have some fun. The Olympics had been an albatross around his neck, a crushing weight of expectation and disappointment. He didn't put any pressure on himself in fighting. That was saved for the big wrestling meets. Fighting was just a gas he was doing on the side, and he performed better than anyone thought possible. He was so good, they called him the natural. Randy arrived at the UFC at the ripening age of 33, and after one fight, he upset the seemingly unstoppable Vitor Belfort. He beat Mo Smith for the title in only his third fight. This was for the heavyweight title, which topped out at 265 pounds. Randy had a contract dispute and was stripped, but he won the title back 2 years later. Randy then lost to the much bigger wrestler Josh Barnett, and the heavyweight division was full of guys who had to cut weight to make 265, while Randy fought at 220 or so. Feeling the squeeze from these behemoths, Randy moved down to light heavy, 205 pounds, and beat Chuck Liddell, another upset. Then came the biggest fight of his career, against Tito Ortiz, when Tito was at his peak, the young unstoppable killer who had bounced nearly out of the cage in his pre-fight warm-up. Randy was 40 years old, and he dominated Tito for 5 rounds in a win that solidified his myth of defying reputation. Overnight, his nickname changed from The Natural to Captain America. Randy then lost twice to Chuck Liddell, who had adjusted his style to perfectly counter Randy. After the second loss, Randy retired from the sport, working as a commentator. He couldn't stay away, and after watching Tim Sylvia defend the heavyweight title in what he felt was lackluster fashion, Randy came out of retirement at the age of 44. The 6'8", 265-pound Sylvia seemed a lock to destroy Randy, and fans worried for Randy's health, until the first few seconds of the fight when Randy, with a perfect game plan, knocked Tim Sylvia on his ass and put it on him for the rest of the fight. Randy defended his new title once against Gabe Gonzaga, with a clinic on how to use the cage as a tool, and then resigned from the UFC. He was chasing the biggest fight in the world, with Fedor Emelianenko, the Russian heavyweight, who was somehow, essentially, unbeaten in MMA, and was generally held as the greatest MMA heavyweight of all time. The UFC, with its restrictive contracts, couldn't sign Fedor, but wouldn't let Randy go, and hung him up in court until Randy was forced to come back. No organization will let its heavyweight champ fight someone it doesn't have a contract with. What if their champion loses? What's the belt worth then? For his welcome back champ fight, he was matched for the title against Brock Lesnar, a wrestling Goliath who outweighed him by 50 pounds. Lesnar is a huge man, built like a silverback gorilla, and a terrific athlete, an NCAA wrestling legend. The first round was classic couture. Randy in control, chipping and scrapping, and the air was pregnant with the possibility of a further demonstration of Couture's greatness. But it was not to be. In the second round, Randy got caught. Brock is unreasonably fast for a man his size, and Randy's head movement had slowed down that last little tick, putting him in reach. Brock punched and Randy moved a second late, got clipped behind the ear, and went down. Maybe at 45, the end is finally on Randy, but it should never detract from what he's accomplished, and when he fights again, don't bet against him. One of the things about being an underdog, there's no pressure. Nobody expects you to win. It frees you up to go out and compete. We often complicate things with fear of failure, all that baggage of winning and losing. Being an underdog is freedom. This knowledge hadn't come easy to Randy. He'd earned it. We sat in his office at Extreme Couture, the Vegas sun spilling like liquid gold outside on the pavement. I realized I get way more nervous for wrestling than for fights, way more keyed up. When I realized that, I thought, that's odd. This guy could kick my head off, but I'm not worried about that at all. I'm having fun. I'm enjoying learning all this new stuff. I stopped and thought, why the hell am I so nervous for the wrestling matches? I'd lost perspective, and I was putting all this pressure on myself. It came down to one match. Everything hinged on it. So I'd forgotten that I loved to wrestle and why I started wrestling. Because it's fun. Randy had been dealing with the systemic pressure that elite athletes face, the overwhelming pressure to succeed. The Olympics is particularly grueling in that respect. There are no seasons, no multiple game series, not many chances to fail. When you've worked every day for 4 years, or a lifetime, for a goal, and all that work comes down to the next 10 minutes, it's hard not to feel pressure, shattering pressure. But it is precisely how you deal with that pressure that dictates your chances of success. It is the catch-22 vice for Olympic athletes. Randy has found his way through. He's regarded as the strongest mental competitor in MMA. He develops uncanny game plans and sticks to them. He knows in his heart that he has as good a chance to win as his opponent. The first thing is perspective. I frame things in a positive way and stay reflective. It's almost a cliche, but in the grand scheme of my life, if the worst thing that happens to me is I lose a wrestling match, even if it's the Olympic finals, then I'm doing pretty damn good. A fight, even a title fight, barely registers. Right away, that takes some of the pressure off. I know I'll survive it. It's not the end of the world. I won't like it. I don't like to lose. But the people who really care about me don't care about me because I win. They care about me and want me to be happy. I think this helps me overcome the classic fear of failure that most athletes set themselves up for. They're so worried about looking stupid or making a mistake. They don't do what they've trained to do. They get in their own way. Randy understands what I'm looking for. You have to put a positive frame on things. In wrestling, in a heated match, sometimes the difference in the match is that you got called for passivity, or your opponent did. You know you're working your ass off, and then the referee decides for whatever reason that you are more passive than your opponent, so the ref gives him the choice, and your opponent sticks you in the disadvantaged position. And it would get to me, because no one was as active as I was in matches. It would really mess with me when I got called for passivity. He shakes his head in remembered frustration. Then I figured out, with my coaches, that it was okay. It was a coin toss. The ref was going to call it on somebody. So why am I getting upset? It was taking me out of my game, and I was losing matches because everyone would put you in the disadvantaged position, and I'd get turned and scored on because I was pissed off. So I started framing it as out of my control, what the referee does. It's no big deal. This is just another thing to beat. Now, my opponent will put me at a disadvantage, but he's still not going to score on me. So, psychologically, that will have a big effect on him. It's one more place where I can break this guy. Who gives a shit what the ref thinks? It's all about my opponent. Once I wrapped my head around that, I started savoring those situations. Not that I ever stalled, but when the passivity call came, I looked at it as a positive. Here's a place where he can't turn me. Another place for me to attack him, wear him down. By creating a different perspective on the same situation, then technically things went a lot better. I thought better, my defense was better, and I had more success. When Yagyu Munenori, the legendary swordsman and contemporary of Musashi's, wrote that another man's sword is your sword, he meant just that. If your understanding is deeper, his weapons are your weapons. You can turn his weapons against him. His own sword is more dangerous to him than to you. The importance of coaching and cornering is not lost on Randy. The corner has to have a real understanding of his fighter, seeing things that he can do. You use a word or phrase when he gets distracted. When he gets flustered or hit, you use the word or phrase to get you centered, bring you back to your training. Maybe move your feet. And that goes to your game plan, footwork. A guy gets caught. His bell gets rung. He needs a place to go mentally, to get him back to safety. For Chuck, it was chin down, hands up. For Tito, it was scramble, don't concede. Because I didn't want to give up the takedown. The Tito fight became about who was going to give up the takedown. If I got it, he was going to have a bad night. And if he got it, I would probably have a bad night. But you have to be careful with the saying, don't get taken down, because that's a negative statement. I was coaching this kid who was winning by 1 point, with 30 seconds left in the match. All he has to do is not get taken down, so I'm screaming, don't get taken down. And what do you think happens? What did I put in his head? Randy frowns and shakes his head ruefully. Instead of giving him positive things to do, get an underhook, tie him up, stay in his face, the things that got him to this point of winning, I give him something negative and he gets tentative. It's the same in fights. Don't get hit by the right hand. Well, shit, I just got nailed by it. He pauses, musing, and then picks up his earlier thread. So that positive phrase will refocus him, keep him on track. You want to be calm and focused, not emotional and excitable. But if he needs a slap in the face to wake him up, you gotta do it. All fighters are different. Forrest Griffin needs to be slapped around the locker room or he'll have a slow start. Kara Parisian is the same way. You gotta jack him up. With Mike Pyle, I try to settle him down. If he's smiling and joking, he'll do well. And if he's intense and inside himself, something's wrong. When you hear Randy describe what he's going to do in a fight, or talk about another fighter, his language is interesting. It's technical and dry and devoid of emotion. Randy sees a problem, a technical problem, not an emotional fight filled with fear and rage. He talks about solving Tim Sylvia's reach advantage like a plumber talks about coming at a leak. There's a reason for this dispassionate observation, and it goes back to wrestling. Even from the beginning, in high school, Randy found what worked was an in-your-face type of wrestling, which required he outwork his opponent. In his book, Wrestling for Fighting, Randy said, "My style certainly wasn't the prettiest, but it proved quite effective. During my senior year in high school, I plodded and pounded my way to the state championships." You could say that he's been plodding and pounding ever since. Randy can't deny his own genetic gifts. He's a natural athlete whose longevity has defied all conventional wisdom on aging. He single-handedly keeps about a dozen aging fighters from retiring. They see him win and think, "Why not me?" But they're not Randy. He was featured on a TV show, National Geographic's Fight Science, where they measured his lactic acid levels, the acid that builds up in muscles as they fatigue and burn oxygen. That tired feeling is lactic acid buildup. Randy was straining and choking a training partner, and his lactic acid levels actually dropped, as did the jaws of the monitoring scientists. Randy may not have been the fastest or most purely athletic wrestler, but he loved to train, and he could train harder than just about anyone. He's smart. At Oklahoma State, after the Army, he had a 4.0 GPA and was an academic All-American as well as a wrestling All-American. Although they called him the natural, Randy never felt that way about himself. He titled his autobiography, Becoming the Natural, and it shows how his career, his success was a process, that it was worked for. It wasn't a free ride on talent. His brain has been his biggest asset in his fighting career. Most other fighters will express admiration for how scientific he is, how technical. Randy was always developing his plodding skills as well as his pounding ones. These skills, watching opponents closely, studying tape, and crafting game plans, were honed to a fine point during that long Olympic chase. In the years that Randy didn't make the team, especially in 92 and 96, he was stuck in the unofficial scrub club. That's what we call the number two and number three guys, the scrub club. We'd travel with the team, but wouldn't get tickets to many events. We were alternates, but it was only until the first weigh-in. After that, you couldn't enter. We scouted. We filmed matches all day long so that the guy we had advancing in the tournament knew who he had next. We filled out scouting reports and watched tons and tons of tape. Even now, Randy sighs at the memories of monotony tinged with gnawing disappointment. That mindset carried over into fighting. I watched because I liked to watch fights. I would watch how guys were technically doing things, making adjustments. Randy had a whole professional life of scouting opponents and breaking down tape, and he applies those lessons to all his fights. He would see what he needed to learn and then hit the gym religiously, intelligently, to learn it. I had several of Vitor Belfort's fights on tape, and I watched them carefully. I saw, okay, he's left-handed and leads every combination with his left. He's very straight ahead, and he'll blow through you if you stand in front of him, so I've got to work on footwork. I had to learn to box because wrestling won't work, so I got a boxing coach and started circling left all day. I was confident that if I could get my hands on him, I could wear him out, make him work harder than he wanted to work. No one gave me a snowball's chance in hell. It was all the new knowledge, hiring new coaches and learning entirely new disciplines that really excited Randy. I love to train and learn. For me, that's like a kid in a candy store. The things I was learning in wrestling at the end of my career were so minuscule, tiny technical variations, little changes to grips, things like that. But fighting had so many dimensions, new techniques, It was as exciting as hell. When I'm done learning, I'm done winning. Randy learned from his own teaching of wrestling. The more I taught, the more I dissected my game. And the more I dissected my game, the more technical I became. A lot of wrestlers never truly take the time to analyze how they do what they do, which makes it difficult for them to go down on all fours with a fine-tooth comb and refine their game, he said in Wrestling for Fighting. He could have learned from Dan Gable, especially Gable's back-off-to-win experience, how Gable had been winning his last match in college, but kept going for the pin and lost. Gable learned that lesson, internalized it, and won with it. In the 96 finals for a berth on the Olympic team, Randy was wrestling against his nemesis Mike Foy. He was winning by 9 points, with 45 seconds left, and could have run all over the mat, and he never would have beat me. But Randy wanted to tech-fall his ass. I wanted to beat him, so I stayed on him, aggressive. Went for that last fall, and I ended up on my back and pinned. Like Dan, that loss is ever fresh. Watching the match today, it's hard to believe that was a pin. Randy was pushing Foy all over the place. In the final seconds, his shoulders brushed the mat as they roll over for the briefest moment. But just as Gable probably never would have had the fire to have the Olympic career he did without losing that final NCAA match, Randy might never have had the fire to succeed in the way he did as a fighter if he'd won a medal in the Olympics. And it's something Randy is tangentially aware of. Even to this day, Randy's wrestling matches are more important to him than his fighting career. When I ask him about losing in general, he talks solely about wrestling. Maybe he thought I meant wrestling, but the mindset is revealing. I lost the NCAA finals twice, and the Olympic trials 4 times when I could have made the team. But I learned to put it in perspective. Randy went into one of his favorite topics. I started thinking about the differences between being nervous and being excited. They're very similar. The physical attributes you assign to each are real similar, and one has negative connotations. Nervousness means something bad is happening and you're not enjoying it. And being excited makes you smile. You love what you're doing and good things are happening. I had gone through a similar experience years ago. When I first thought about being a writer, I was anxious about the future, about not knowing where I was going to be living in 3 or 4 months, never having a salary. I realized that I couldn't do that, not if I wanted to be a writer. I couldn't live in a state of anxiety. It had to be excitement. I tell that to friends or people I meet who want to be writers or artists, anybody who wants to do something different, a job without security. Don't let it be anxiety. Let that uncertainty generate excitement. If you can't make that switch, you shouldn't be a writer or an artist or a fighter. You won't enjoy it. There have been plenty of scientific studies that show how laughter and being relaxed reduces stress hormones and performance inhibitors. Smiling changes our brain. It's common sense, Sports Psych 101. Randy's own relationship with fear is distinct, studied. He turns his opponents into athletic puzzles. It's not about them, personally, and he has no emotion about them. In the Tim Sylvia fight, I knew it was going to be a little problem for Tim, because he fights on emotion. He has to generate a little dislike, a little anger. And Tim and I are friends. He stayed at my house. I knew that would make things a little harder for him, because he respects me. Randy has no problem fighting his friends because of where he comes from, the wrestling. It's not personal. It's problem solving. With Chuck Liddell, I knew there was a distinct risk that if I did what I had to do to beat him, I could get knocked out. So at some point, you have to make friends with the worst case possibility. But hey, if the worst thing that happens is you lose a fucking fight, you're doing good. So risk it. Randy is a competitor. It's something that gets said a lot. He loves the process, the training and learning. But the pinnacle of competition for him is when you see your opponent break. Once you do it, you realize that's what it's all about. I never even really saw it until I went to Oklahoma State. But you open a guy's eyes to that mindset, and it changes him. The first time that I felt it was with Vitor. Randy smiles avidly. Here's something he enjoys remembering, trying to quantify. It's almost a noise. I liken it to a stick snapping. You can hear it, feel the stick break. He mimes snapping a stick in half. Tito was close. He struggled with it. From the third round on, I would take him right to the edge. I would feel the will start to go, and he screamed. He'd find a way. He knew he was close to giving up, but he'd come storming back. He'd try and fight and find a way to fight on. He never really did break. He was right there teetering, and I couldn't push him over. You need to have the conditioning and mentality to stay one step ahead. Make them work and keep scoring, and frustrate them, until they try and stop it some other way. With Vitor, I felt the tension leave him, and shortly after, he fell over. There was no big shot, but all these little ones. Physically, he'd reached his limit. Randy talked at length about breaking a fighter's will, saying the way you do it is through conditioning, being one step ahead of them. Keep making them work, keep scoring. At some point, they'll break and give in to you. They'll try and make it stop some other way. In wrestling, our national coach was big on grind matches. You do your own warm-up for 15 minutes, and then wrestle with one partner for 90 minutes straight. You didn't stop, drink water, or do anything but go for 90 minutes. And I saw more guys break in that time. I saw guys start crying. Randy talked about watching Rulon Gardner, a heavyweight, and his brother Reynold, who didn't look like anything athletically, but they'd flat push guys and break their hearts. I asked Randy if he ever broke in those grind matches, and he smiles a little smile, his special secret. You know, I never broke. I got beat up plenty, but I never broke. I go with the heavyweights like Rulon, and they physically beat me up, and I couldn't score, but I never got to the point where I quit trying. I have no idea why. Everybody has their limit. I'm sure I have my limit too. I've just never reached it in a 90-minute grind match. Or in a 5-round MMA title fight. There may very well be something that could break Randy, some limit. But you get the feeling, it's not a fight. It never always gets worse. There is magic in far running. There's an aura, a mystique around the Paiute Indians, who could somehow make 100 miles in a day across the Mojave. Or the Japanese marathon monks of Mount Hiei, who cover a route of 49 miles every day for months on end. Today's ultra-marathoners run races of more than 100 miles in the desert heat or southern forests. These are mysterious, mythic figures covering such immense distances that mere mortals tremble in uncertainty and disbelief. It can't be, but it is. And so often dismissed, with a shrug or a shake of the head, into the realm of modern legend, half-believed, incomprehensible. I remember as a child reading about colonial New England and Canada, of the French coureurs de bois, the fur trappers, the runners of the woods, making 50 miles a day in the winter, wearing snowshoes, and then wrapping themselves in bearskin and sleeping under a tree. It sounded outlandish that they could be so different from us, so much tougher. I took a wilderness EMT course in New Hampshire in 2002 to help my wildland firefighting career. One of the instructors had been an Ironman triathlete. I had asked him about the absurd thing that was an Ironman race, to swim 2.4 miles, bike 112 miles, and then run a marathon. He had laughed at my attitude, the common attitude. I could never do that. "You don't know how fast you are," he said. I ran my first half marathon, and then a little while later ran my first marathon, in the same time. It's all mental, all in the push. I fought fire with a guy who'd been a Division I cross-country runner, and he'd said with a shake of his shaggy head, "It's all mental, dude." Kyle Klingman, the young assistant at the Dan Gable Wrestling Museum, had told me he wasn't a wrestler, but I could see he was some kind of athlete. He had a cadaverous look, a tinge of the fanatic in his eyes that had initially puzzled me. Then I found out he ran ultramarathons. When I asked him about that mentality, Kyle led me to David Horton, a strange, legendary character even among the rogues gallery of ultra runners. Horton once held the Appalachian Trail record, that famous trail that runs 2,175 miles from Georgia to Maine. He'd run it in 52 days, 9 hours. I'd met fast-through hikers who did it in 4 months. Horton had run the thing, 40-plus miles a day for more than 50 days. He'd run the third-best time in the Transamerica, a race from L.A. to New York. And he'd recently, at the age of 55, crushed the record for the Pacific Crest Trail, 2,650 miles in 66 days, a feat well documented in The Runner, a film by another ultra-runner, J.B. Benna of Journey Films. Ultra-running is defined as anything longer than a marathon, which is 26 miles. Usually the races are either 50 or 100 miles, or they take place over a series of days. What Horton does is on the far end of even that extreme category. Horton was also a professor of kinesiology at Jerry Falwell's Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia, where he also taught running. He was a big Dan Gable fan. Kyle gave me his number, and I caught up with him for a phone call. We started talking about Dan Gable. Horton was effusive. I think he's the toughest athlete that I know of. I can't think of anyone tougher. Not only his wrestling, but his coaching. Why was he like that? Sure, his parents helped, and his situation. But I think he was just a tougher-than-nails little boy, too. Horton's voice is accented and charming, with some of that southern courtliness and rhythm. He's eloquent, used to expounding and teaching, comfortable in that role, but pure and honest. Everything false has been burned away. Like many great fighters, there's mostly honesty and pure emotion. Like an asteroid falling to the earth, these people have endured so much beyond the limits of what they thought was human endurance that any falseness and cuteness, anything extraneous, got seared off. "Do you feel that overtraining is a myth?" I asked him. "Yes, overtraining is a myth," he said. "The harder you train, the more you train, the better you'll do. World-class athletes train on the verge of injury. A guy I know who finished second in the Transamerica race said he took a leave of absence from his job and for 2 months, in preparation, averaged 50 miles a day. The Transamerica foot race, of which there have been 8, is held in 64 stages, on 64 straight days, and the time is cumulative. This race was 9 weeks, averaging 317 miles per week. Day after day of 52 miles, 44 miles, 36 miles, back to 52 miles. How do you prepare for something like that? I said to him, "I feel that was a little too much." And he agreed with me. For 2 months, I averaged 160 miles a week, about half what he did, and I ran the third fastest time ever. Was that too much? Nope, that was about right. But who knows? Maybe if I'd done more, I'd have done better. But the only way to find out is to do it again. So maybe overtraining isn't exactly a myth, I thought. You should just behave as if it is, until you can prove otherwise by injuring yourself. It's not a myth, but you need to pretend it is. Horton's voice swoops and swirls over the phone, animated. I bet he's a good teacher. He understands that to teach, you have to entertain. Ted Corbett, the father of ultra running, a black man, just passed away in the last few years. He was in New York, and he'd train 150, 170, 200 miles a week. And this is at a time when 40 or 50 miles a week was thought of as outrageous. He found 200 worked for him. When I explained my project and asked him about the mental game in ultra running, I could hear him inhale thoughtfully down the line. "It's a tough subject," he said. "If you ask me what percentage for the split between mental and physical, I often say it's 80-50, which of course doesn't quite add up. Any sport like this, with a prolonged level of discomfort, it's going to have a strong mental component. Success in ultras depends on the ability to sustain discomfort for prolonged periods of time, whether it's hours or days or many days. It's just that. All it takes to relieve it is to stop. And that's what we're fighting against all the time." It was interesting to think about. Winning the battle against the urge to stop, that's what it takes. It reminded me of the difference between a combat photographer and a soldier in a war. The soldier has no choice. He has to be there. While the photographer is facing a test of courage, an endurance test, that he can leave at any time and go home. Easier to be brave for the photographer when it's a choice. The body can always do more than the mind thinks it can. In the first year of the Transamerica, running from Los Angeles to New York, a young man got a stress fracture in Missouri, and for a period of a couple weeks, he still had to run the average of 45 miles a day, and he was just barely making the cutoffs, but he made them. And toward the end, his foot started recovering, and he started running fast again. The first time I did the Appalachian Trail, I was averaging 40 miles a day from Georgia to Maine, he says almost in a sing-song. He's told this story so many times. On days 8, 9, and 10, I had severe tendonitis in one shin. And one day, all day long, I was urinating blood. For 1,000 miles, I was dealing with shin splints, icing, and using anti-inflammatories. But then finally, they got well. Your body sends signals to your mind. It's time to stop. Let up. This doesn't feel good. It hurts. The mind has to override the signal. You know those little glass globe candles on the tables at restaurants? With a narrow opening at the top, just a few inches across? Now, you can put your hand over the mouth of that candle, and if you hold it there long enough, the flame will go out. But it'll hurt. If someone bets you $10, you might try it. But it starts to burn a little, and you jerk your hand away. Now, if someone told you, "I'll give you $1,000,000," now there are all sorts of signals in your mind. That's what mental training is about, learning to deal with signals and what you can override and what you shouldn't. I asked him about the ability to override, where it comes from. It's not an easy thing. It's very difficult, and it doesn't come overnight. Anytime I go out to do something extremely difficult, I always wonder, do I have the edge this time? Because I've done it before, does it mean I can do it again? I thought about Tom Brands, Gable's apostle, talking about the mysteries of tough guys. You get the sense David Horton takes to the trail in some way to see what will happen, out of curiosity, to see where his mind and body will take him once he's gone farther than he thought he could. It's still about how bad do you want it. Once you've achieved some major thing, can you repeat? Sometimes you can. Sometimes you can't. I asked him about the athlete's dilemma. How to tell what kind of pain it is. Is the pain just hurting, or is it from being injured? Trial and error, the only way. No book or magazine can tell you, and it doesn't matter what other people say. Say you sprain your ankle. Should you stop and ice it, or keep going? Every time I've sprained an ankle, I kept going. But does that mean everyone should? No. He thought about it for a moment. I've seen broken bones that didn't swell up, and things swell up hugely that there was nothing really wrong with. The only way to know is experience. And to have that drive to push through, that first time, to see, to go find out. I watched The Runner, the documentary about Horton's record-breaking Pacific Crest Trail run from Mexico to Canada in 66 days with a 300,000-foot total elevation change. That's averaging more than 4,500 feet of change a day, which is horrific. It's an ungodly amount of up and down. There were a few things that kept coming to mind when I watched the documentary. Here was a guy who wore his heart on his sleeve. His emotions and feelings are out there in play. He obviously can harness them and put them to work. When I asked him about using his emotions, David responded eagerly, almost confessing a dirty secret. One of the things I do, it sounds strange, I sometimes will make myself cry. I'll think about my family or home, or I'll start singing a sad song and I'll start crying. Then, after I cry, I feel better. Not just mentally, but physically. Physically, I feel better. He constructs a cathartic release for himself, something the ancient Greeks thought would restore and purify you. The other thing that struck me, watching the documentary, was the dual nature of David. Sometimes, at rest, he seemed frail, some 55-year-old machine, too old to have a hope of success, already past his limit. But then, when he runs, there's a sense of iron running through his body, a large chunk of steel woven inside that fragile, aging human frame, endlessly durable, wound tight. Commitment to a goal. That's a big part of ultra running. Doing what you said you were going to do. It's as simple as that. Part of it is that I tell people, I have a team that helps me. David sets himself up. He talks about his goals to give him another reason not to quit later. He's told everyone he knows he's doing it. The Appalachian Trail, the Transamerica, the PCT. Once I start one of those things, I'm totally committed. I don't view it as dedication. It's just something I do. It's like the light switch in my office. When I open the door and turn on the switch, the light comes on. That's what I do when I start running. I don't think about it. I just get up in the morning and go. To me, it's not dedication. It's commitment. Once in a while, people crack. On these long things. This was a term David would use often, these long things. And he meant the incredible endurance races or self-tests. There's something poignant about it. Something loose and generic. He could be talking about something else, not a race, but some terrible trial, an illness, a war. By and large, once people get into these long things, they don't stop. They just keep going. It's not dedication or mental toughness. You just keep doing it. I asked him about it, the kinds of games you play with yourself. There are two statements that I use, he said. The first is simple. This too shall pass. It will end. It can't last forever. Because sometimes things will feel that way. David is one of the very few finishers of the Barkley Marathon, an ultramarathon that makes even professional ultrarunners shudder and cross themselves. It's sometimes referred to as the race that eats its young. In 1973, Gary Cantrell had been hiking in Frozen Head Park in Tennessee when he saw an ancient trail marked on the map, considered by the park to be impassable. When he went back later, Gary was thinking of the recent prison break of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassin, James Earl Ray, who had made 4 miles through the woods in 55 hours from a nearby prison. The terrain was too harsh for Ray to make it any farther. Gary thought he could do 100 miles in that time, even in similar terrain. In 1985, he finally hiked it, and then he started the race the next year. The Barkley was born. A 100-mile race through the woods, 5 horrible loops up steep, thorny mountains, over fallen trees and under bushes, with very little support in terms of aid stations and water. Even the trail is easy to lose. There are 11 books hidden along the way, and the runners must find the books and tear out a page. It became infamous in the small ultramarathon world as the hardest, baddest, most miserable experience in running. It breaks top professionals all the time, with a total vertical climb of 54,000 feet, trees down crossing the trail, mudslides. David Horton was one of the 7 finishers, in under 60 hours, of the 650, who have attempted it since 1986. If you want to enter, you have to write a long essay about why I should be allowed to run the Barkley, even to get a chance to race. As Cantrell once said, to run the Barkley is to know humility and fear. Horton had survived and triumphed because of his second maxim. The second one is very, very important. It never always gets worse, he said and paused, reverential. He wanted me to think about that one. A lot of people think this way. If you said you just ran 10 miles, they'd say, that's great. Or if you said you just ran a marathon, they'd say, that's fantastic. He sighed. You run a 50-mile race and they say, that's stupid. It's crazy. Now, why is that? The reason is, people theorize, I know how I feel when I run 5 miles or 26 miles and that hurts. So 50 miles must be twice the pain and torture. But it isn't. It never always gets worse. Sometimes it gets worse, but then sometimes it'll go away. He seemed boggled with amazement. I've been in races where I was trashed, I was dog meat, and a day or 2 days later I felt chipper, I felt good. So when you're in a bad race, and it's 10 miles into a 50-mile race, and it's hurting bad right now, what's it going to be at 40? He breathed and changed his tone, his voice falling mellow and clear. It may feel a lot better, and there's only one way to find out. David was a professor at a Christian college, and I knew that he'd been saved. I asked him about his faith. To me, it's simple. I'm God's creation. The earth is God's creation. And God gives us different talents and abilities. We're supposed to use and develop our talents, to get out the mission and the word. My calling, the things I do, God has enabled me. To teach, to run, to do long, long things. To me, it's one ball of wax. I'm a runner and a Christian. I'm running on God's creation, and I'm God's creation myself. It made me think of a quote from Zen in The Art of Archery. For them, the masters, the contest consists in the archer aiming at himself, and yet not at himself, in hitting himself, and yet not himself, and thus becoming simultaneously the aimer and the aim. Who would ever have thought it? Did I think it would go this way? No, I never did. I think of two verses, Philippians 4:13 and 4:19. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. If God wants me to do this, his strength is unbelievable. On the PCT, I knew I would finish this thing. It was just a question of how long, how much torture and pain. I knew God wanted me to do it. God will supply all my needs according to his riches and glory. What percent of our brain, our strength, our lungs goes unused most of the time? When you hear about a person lifting a car off a loved one, is that God giving us strength? Or is that God allowing us to find the hidden strength we already have? The answer is yes, both. We have a phenomenal amount of power, and he can give it to us. I do know, in every person, Christian or non-Christian, saved, lost, that our bodies are capable of so much more than we think possible. Watching or reading about David finishing the Appalachian Trail or the Pacific Crest Trail is strangely moving, even sublime. Although the rational mind understands the endeavor to be absurd, ridiculous, pointless in the practical sense, it seems a twisted form of hapless masochism. Yet it is also proof of the power of pure will, of a man's ability to do so much more than thought possible. And in some way, this ennobles us all. The Consistent Improver. The Ultimate Fighter reality show began in 2005 on Spike TV, an offshoot and feeder for the Ultimate Fighting Championship, which had previously only been on pay-per-view. The show, specifically the free fights, broke MMA into mainstream America. It was part of the reality TV craze, but in all honesty, the show's popularity was due to the fights. At the end of each show, contestants, young hopefuls, would fight an unedited MMA fight. It was the fight that brought the viewers, a chance to watch MMA without paying $40. For fight fans, it was sometimes hard to watch, simply because of the inexperience of the contestants. Nerves play a huge role in fighting. Studies have shown, as Pat Miletich said, that a sky-high heart rate affects your thinking, vision, and hearing, and that the only way to maintain a reasonable heart rate in a fight is by living through it. Fighters make peace with the terror of fight or flight and learn to harness it. But it takes time. Fighting professionally, on a national stage, requires a tremendous amount of experience to perform well. Any boxing match you've seen on TV, most likely the fighters have had 100 amateur bouts and at least 10 or 15 professional ones. After years of work like that, the boxers look smooth and graceful, professional. The fighters on Spike, with a chance to win a shot at the big show, had records that were more along the lines of 4-1 or even 2-0. The young fighters went through all the growing pains that often don't get seen by the public, freezing in a fight or completely abandoning game plans. The fights were very raw, and in some cases exciting. Hardcore fight fans watched, because they were free, but were critical, sometimes without understanding quite why. They just weren't used to seeing guys this inexperienced on TV. Kenny Florian, an underdog on the first show, was a contestant with a Brazilian jiu-jitsu background and only a few MMA fights. He was drastically undersized, but tougher than expected, and he made it to the finals, where he succumbed to nerves and the relentless pressure of a hard wrestler, Diego Sanchez, an experienced MMA fighter with a pro record of 11-0. Kenny was an ordinary-looking college kid, and he was, in fact, ridiculously small for the 185-pound weight class. He moved down from 185 past 170, and finally to his natural weight class of 155. Kenny looks like somebody I could have gone to school with, a college kid from Boston. But he'd found and excelled in Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and then MMA. He'd taken two losses, two huge, grinding losses, and somehow come away stronger, come away a better fighter. Those losses had made him. I met Kenny on the outskirts of Boston, in Somerville, at Sichotang, Mark Delagrati's Muay Thai school. I worked out a few times with Kenny and his strength coach, Kevin Kearns, and over a few weeks developed a conversation with him. Kenny has an open, smiling way and a friendly manner, and instantly we were laughing and joking. He's of the same humor background as I am. We did voices from The Simpsons and other brilliant repartee. He's medium height, with a big head and a large, noble nose. Maybe some Peruvian Indian in there somewhere, peeking out. Thick black hair and eyebrows, and an instant open grin that squeezes his eyes to slits, familiar creases on his cheeks. Kenny Florian laughs a lot. His sense of confidence is powerful, non-threatening, but complete. He's been in deep waters. He swum with muscle sharks and come back alive. Kenny's parents are from Peru, although they're of European descent. So that nose is Italian, maybe. His father was a surgeon who came to the United States to study and stayed for the opportunities. Kenny talks admiringly about how driven his dad was, how he wouldn't take no for an answer when it came to going to the medical school he wanted. He taught me a lot about determination, about proving people wrong, and never being afraid to work hard. Some people accept their limitations, but my dad never saw any reason why you couldn't be the best. Kenny was recruited by Olympic soccer development out of high school, and he played at Boston College, which is Division I, but he wasn't sure there was anywhere to go afterward. Professional soccer in 1999 wasn't established in the United States, and a hobby was starting to dominate his dreams. As a kid, he'd seen the first UFC and thought it was awesome, the real deal. Kenny had the young boy's fantasy that I and so many other American males had, of being Bruce Lee, able to beat up 15 guys without getting a scratch. When I was a kid, my older brother Edgar would have me fight in what I called the Pancration Olympics. He was the Don King in the neighborhood. He'd set up fights between all the kids. He was an instigator. He'd get them to foot race, and then to box with the gloves on, and then, well, let's see who's tougher. Take the gloves off. Kenny laughed. It was much later that Kenny and his older brother Keith stumbled into jiu-jitsu. They saw Royce Gracie do the unthinkable. The moves made sense to me, Kenny said about his early affinity for jiu-jitsu. It became his secret other girlfriend, the one he was thinking about when he should have been thinking about soccer. She was always on his mind. Kenny is, in many ways, a difficult figure for me to reconcile personally. He's not a huge, ripped, preternaturally fast guy, and although he's an obvious athlete, he doesn't seem like one. Instead, he's a guy who believes in himself, in an interesting way. He makes me embarrassed about my own mental limitations. My goal is to beat the hell out of the last Kenny Florian I fought, he says over lunch. I'm going to look at his game and blow him out of the water. You can't compare yourself to Fedor, to BJ Penn, or to those tippy-top guys. You really want to be as good as you can possibly be. You want to be able to be the most amazing fighter that you could ever be. Someone who can do things that Fedor or George St. Pierre can't possibly comprehend. I always felt like I started too late. I didn't find Muay Thai until I was 26 years old, and I'm not a beast. I don't have great hand speed or power that can make up for a lack of experience. I would always justify my shying away from turning pro like this. I'm not that good an athlete. I could play and practice basketball every day for my whole life, and I'd never be Michael Jordan, right? What Kenny is remonstrating is that, sure, you'll never be Michael Jordan, but you could be something else. You could be a great professional NBA player in your own style. Maybe a great passer or a three-point shooter. it comes around to an important facet of fighting, acknowledging your identity and working to make it the best version of you. We all could be great, but we have to open our